It's an exceptional year when two or three really great films are released, but consider 1939, when not only Gone with the Wind, Wuthering Heights, and The Wizard of Oz came out, but also Stagecoach, Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington, and Love Affair. And every one of them was nominated for Best Picture that year. Starting this Saturday, you'll be able to see all of them on the big screen, thanks to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, in a series called Hollywood's Greatest Year. It'll be hosted by Turner Classic Movies' popular host, Robert Osborne. And I'm very pleased he was able to join me now and discuss this special summer screening series. Welcome back to
the show. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. Except hearing that music, I really want to go out and fight the Civil War again. It inspires me.
Do you really think that 1939 was the greatest year? Some people say 1946, which was pretty terrific.
Well, 46 was great. 38 was pretty great. 1950, when you got Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve and Born Yesterday and Father the Bride and Harvey, and it was a pretty great year, too. But I would say that, you know, you rarely get films as classic as Wizard of Oz and Stagecoach and Gone with the Wind and all those others, Gunga Din and others that weren't nominated for the Academy Award. So I do think it's a pretty great year.
What that really tells me is that something's gone wrong, because we don't have years anything like that anymore.
No, we don't. But, you know, the things were so different then. And I think one of the things was that we got so many great – that was right at the time that the war was going on in Europe and hadn't quite struck the United States as yet. But all those immigrants from Germany and Austria were coming, and they were all fairly young men getting out away from the Nazis, and because they were Jewish, and coming to Hollywood, where what was already a filmmaking capital, so they could pursue their craft. So you're getting Billy Wilder at his youngest and feistiest, and you're getting Ernst Lubitsch, who is not that young but was still feisty, and the Otto Preminger's of the world, and the great Franz Waxman's and Korngold's, and all those great musicians coming in as one melting pot of Hollywood.
And we're nearing the end of the Depression as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got, times are getting better in many ways, and you've got all this energy. The motion picture screen has also now learned how to handle sound and do all of that. So they were kind of at their best. So it all kind of came together at a magical time.
And Technicolor was coming in as well.
Technicolor had been perfected, yes.
Don't they usually limit the Best Picture nominations to 5 films?
But they do
this
now.
This is 10.
Yes, they did for several years. You know, it took a while to kind of break down all the categories of the Academy so they were more uniform. And they've changed through the years. But for many years, there were 10 nominees for Best Picture, and that was one of it. I think it started being less in like 1944, I believe. I think 1943 was another year where there were 10. And in one year, there was even 12 nominees.
Well, do you think that the 10 that were nominated were the 10 best films?
Well, there
of
were
year?
Certainly 10 great films, but there were films like Gunga Din, and The Women didn't even get a single Academy Award nomination. And now it's one of the great classic comedies of all time, considered that. So, but I think that many of them on the list, practically all of them, deserve to be there. I haven't seen Of Mice and Men for a long time, so I'm looking forward to seeing it at the Academy, as a matter of fact, in that screening. Also, one thing we have to say about these Academy screenings, not only do you get to see Gone with the Wind on the big screen, which gives it whole different values than it would, you know, seeing it on television, but also seeing archival prints of these, because the Academy never shows anything that's not a really fabulous print. So that's a great treat as well.
So they've gone back and restruck new prints?
Yes, or they have prints originally that haven't been, you know, gone through the projectors so often that they're torn up in any way.
Is it possible, in looking back, to see all of these films as representing something specific about the time?
Specific about the time? Well,
I mean, was America more hopeful at this time, or do we see a certain amount of anxiety in these films?
Well, I think certainly that the movies were being made then were all end on somewhat of a hopeful note. But I think that's what made movies what they are, which filmmakers today have kind of forgotten about.
Well, just Gone with the Wind end on a hopeful note? Or?
Well, I think it does, in a way. Positive, I'll get it back. You know, tomorrow's another day.
It's give a damn.
Yes. Well, but, you know, she's going to get it back. You know that feisty little vixen. Of course you will. But, no, I think that, you know, even something like High Sierra, which came out in 1941, the leading character in it, the criminal played by Humphrey Bogart, is killed, shot up in the Sierra Mountains. And his little dog goes and licks at his dead hand, and his girlfriend, Ida Lupino, picks up the dog and is walking towards the camera, But all of a sudden she's thinking, oh, he's better off where he is. Life goes on. Da-da-da-da. So there's this kind of hopeful thing, but our movies don't do that anymore.
Although it is interesting that George Raft was originally offered the role and wouldn't take it because he died in the end.
Yes.
And it made Humphrey Bogart's career.
Humphrey Bogart
was kind of boycotted in Hollywood up until that point. So I guess that was another hopeful sign.
Yeah, exactly.
My guest is Robert Osborne. We're talking about a series, Hollywood's Greatest Year, the Best Picture Nominees of 1939, which will be shown starting Saturday the 20th at the Academy Theater.
With Gone with the Wind.
And that'll be the first one. Mm-hmm. At the Lighthouse International, 111 East 59th Street. Many people have talked about how the book compares to the film. Some people think that the film is better than the book.
Well, I'm not sure of that. I think it's a great, great film. I think it is one of the masterpieces of the cinema industry, and I understand why it's the yardstick that all films are compared to and has been ever since 1939. But I must say that for years I didn't read the book because I thought, well, I've seen the movie several times and I don't need to read the book. I've been through that territory. But I did read it. A friend challenged me to read it. A friend in Chicago, and he actually read it at the same time I did, and we would kind of compare it. Well, so marvelous about the book is it's a really great history of the Civil War, written by a writer who was fascinated by research and history. But it also fills in a lot of the blanks and makes the characters in the movie even more interesting.
Well, isn't it a miracle that this movie turned out as good as it did? After all, how many directors did it have?
Well, it had about seven altogether that worked on it.
Started with George Cukor.
George Cukor, and then Sam Wood worked on it some. There are many people directed many scenes in it. King Vidor directed some of the scenes in it. But Victor Fleming is the one who got the credit for it. But you know, I have to say that wasn't so unusual to have happen. Because I did an interview once with George Sidney, the MGM director of musicals such as Kiss Me, Kate and Showboat. And because he was known as a musical director, he said that many times he'd be working on a movie, say, directing Cass Timberlane with Spencer Tracy and Lana Turner. And Mervyn Roy, for instance, would come over and say, hey, I'm directing Million Dollar Mermaid with Esther Williams. I've done all the dramatic scenes. Would you come over and take care of the musical scenes? Because that's what you do. And I can do this with Lana and Spencer Tracy. So there was no big deal about that.
Well, that was the studio system.
Yeah, the studio system. You jumped in and helped, and you weren't. And it's very well known that King Vidor directed all of the sepia tone sequences in The Wizard of Oz, including the tornado and also Judy Garland singing Over the Rainbow. But he gets no credit for that
because it was studio styles,
right?
And everybody knew how to work within the style,
right?
What went into the decision to pair Dark Victory and Wuthering Heights for one of these screenings?
Well, they wanted to do double features, except with Gone with the Wind, and on the weekends to do a double feature. Some of them are on Monday nights, and they're single features, such as Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is a single feature, Nanotchka is a single feature. But the decision was to try to put films that were somewhat of the same mood or essence. So you've got Wuthering Heights and Dark Victory. They're both, you know, on the dramatic side, you've got Stagecoach and Of Mice and Men, which are a little lustier stories, and Love Affair and Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which are two kind of weepy stories.
Well, it's interesting that Selznick wanted to cast Greta Garbo in the role in Dark Victory.
Yes.
Because I can't imagine anybody but Betty Davis. That performance has
now
become
iconic.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so great. But no, when Selznick was producing at MGM Studios, which was run by his father-in-law at that time, L.B. Mayer, he had a production unit, and he was going to do Dark Victory with Greta Garbo and Frederick March. And then Garbo got cold feet about it and didn't want to do it. Frederick March was already signed, and the one thing that Garbo did want to do was Anna Karenina. So instead, he produced Anna Karenina with the two of them.
And you have Garbo's Nanotchka. She did that.
Nanotchka,
that year.
Absolutely. And that was supposed to have been directed by George Cukor. And then all at the last minute, he was switched to do The Women. And Lubitsch, who was to do The Women, was switched to do Nanotchka.
And that worked out well,
it
too,
worked
didn't
out very well,
it?
Both
of them were perfect for those. So the director, pairing the director to the film, although, as we've just learned, the director wasn't always the director, but that was a key factor. Nanotchka is Garbo's first full comedy role, isn't
it? First full comedy role, yes, and her last great film. She only did one film after that, which was another comedy role, a Two-Faced Woman, that Cukor did direct, and that was not a very successful film.
Well, this one was Garbo Laughs. I guess they could have said Garbo Laughs again.
Well, it had Garbo Rumbas, Garbo, what was it? Garbo Rumbas, Garbo in a bathing suit, Garbo whatever. And, you know, what had happened actually was the word come along, the big profits from the Garbo films were in Europe. That's where they really made the money. She fascinated Americans, but they didn't really go see her films. So she actually, what they thought is during the Second World War, when Europe was cut off from having films sent over there, they decided to do a more Americanized Garbo, give her a Claudette Colbert kind of role or one that Carol Lombard might play, and it didn't work. But she never retired. She was going to get back to the work after the war. And then when the war was over, she, being somewhat lazy and also very adamant about what she would and wouldn't do, never found a property that would bring her back.
Well, Nanochka was perfect for her.
Yeah,
she's
great.
So charming. You paired Love Affair and Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Love Affair would be remade a couple of times in 1957 as An Affair to Remember with Cary Grant and Deborah Carr, and then in 1994 with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. What do you think it is? What is it about that material that has inspired so many different film
directors? Well, I think the first one was so great. Love Affair, this original one with Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne, is so wonderful.
Well, Boyer was great in everything he did,
don't you
think? Yeah, just
great. So underrated. And so was she. I mean, she was incredible.
Hold Back the Dawn is one of my favorite films. Mitchell Lyson with a script by Billy Wilder.
Billy Wilder, yeah. Kind of based on Billy Wilder's life a little bit in him trying to get into this country and marrying to do so. Anyway, it's one of those things. And of course, when Cary Grant and Deborah Carr did it, it was so enormously popular that it inspired Warren Beatty to want to do it. But I must say that as much as I like the Cary Grant Deborah Carr version, I think this black and white version with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne is even better.
And then Goodbye, Mr. Chips actually had the reverse effect. It made the book into a bestseller. But it's hard to believe that Robert Donat would beat out Clark Gable, Jimmy Stewart, Laurence Olivier, and Mickey Rooney for Best Actor.
It is hard to believe till you see that movie. And then, oh, my God, is he good. He is so good in that movie. And that was remade, you know, by Peter O'Toole and Petula Clark. And I think that's a very good movie, too. And actually, Peter O'Toole was nominated for the Oscar for that. But the problem was, I think they should have had a different title on it. Mm. If it hadn't been called Goodbye, Mr. Chips, people wouldn't have equated it with the other film that they remembered so affectionately.
It's hard to believe that John Ford shopped around Stagecoach to several studios, all of which turned him down.
Yeah.
Because of John Wayne?
Well, I'm not sure about that. But, you know, in those days, Westerns weren't important films. I mean, that was one of the first really important Westerns that had been done. Back in the silent screen days, there was one called The Covered Wagon, which did rather well. Cimarron, if you want to call it a Western, but it's not really. But, you know, I think it was the fact of a Western. It's like when Hitchcock tried to get Gary Cooper to come and do the movie The Foreign Correspondent. And Cooper said, you know, I can't do that. That's like a thriller, you know. And
who'd been beneath him?
Well, big stars didn't do thrillers then. Thrillers were like B pictures or, you know, Saturday matinee movies. So he wouldn't do it. And he later told Hitchcock, that's the biggest mistake I ever made.
On the other hand, Jimmy Stewart did quite well with Westerns over the years.
Yes, he did very well.
Anthony Mann Westerns and the like.
He did. But even earlier when he did like Destry Rides Again and things like that, he was fun.
Didn't you know Paul Henry?
I did. Actually,
did you ever talk to him about Dark Victory?
He directed me in a TV show one time. Done on a set, actually, where he'd filmed Sinbad the Sailor years before with Maureen O'Hara. Yes, I did talk to him about it.
Because I've always wondered about that two-cigarette bit.
Well,
who came up with that?
Well, he claims he did, but of course, Bette Davis claims that was kind of her idea. I think Irving Rapper said that was his idea. But what's so interesting, if you read the book, Now Voyager, that it's based on, it's in the book. So I think it came from the original author.
One of the other bonuses to seeing going to the series is all the films will be preceded by one of the year's animated shorts and a chapter from
Buck Rogers,
1939.
With Buster Crabbe, yes, indeed. Make a whole movie event out of it because that's how movies were actually shown in those days.
And the unfortunate thing is they would be shown, they'd have their run, and that unless they made it into the repertory theaters, that was it until TCM and AMC came along.
We actually have a recording that Olivia de Havilland did for this screening and the one done by the Academy in Los Angeles, in which she actually talks about that when they made Gone with the Wind, She said, you know, movies never had a lifespan beyond like 3 years. They'd do the first runs and the second run, sometimes the third run, but that was it. And that they had great hope, she said, that this was a movie that would last. They had hopes that maybe for 5 years it might be shown. You know, so it's astounding to her at the age of 93, sitting in Paris now, that here 70 years later, people are still seeing the film.
Well, television also made Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz specials, and so they got to be shown again and again, and they are the bookends of the series, which will begin be shown on Saturdays, generally as double features at 12:30 and 3:30, with pre-shows at noon and 3 o'clock, on Monday nights at 7:30, with pre-shows at 7 o'clock. And if you want all the information about the schedule and ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. And I want to thank you, Robert Osborne.
My pleasure always to talk to you, Leonard.
And 1939, I wasn't even born yet.
Great year.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is the wizard of a wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does.